Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl and my guest today is Evgeny Morozov from Belarus or from United States?
I guess both at this point.
Okay, we come later to this.
Or from cyberspace, I can also add.
Okay, live from the internet. And my co-moderator today is Falk Lücke.
Well, hi, I'm Falk Lücke from the German Federation of Consumer Organizations.
Yeah, we have this guest today coming from the cyberspace or from Belarus or from United States because of the Republica, our conference on blogs, social media and the digital society starting on Wednesday. And you, Evgeny, are one of our keynote speakers. Mm-hmm. What which topic will you talk about?
Well, you know, I've been studying the political role that the internet has in authoritarian closed societies. And for a number of years now, I've been somewhat skeptical that it could actually empower the democratic forces to the degree that we expect them to get empowered. Right? We look at a lot of flashy pictures coming out of Iran with young people holding mobile phones, and there is automatically this expectation that these people are going to challenge the government no matter what. And this is problematic because it's just one side, I think, of technology's impact. And there are many others. You know, there is the government side, how the government itself is mobilizing and utilizing some of these networks to track dissent, for example, to survey some of those activists and dissidents. But there are many other sides. You know, there are a lot of non-state actors which are not necessarily part of the government by definition, but they're also not very conducive to democratization, right? And those also are using the internet. So I guess in my talk on Wednesday, my major challenge would be to try to very coherently and succinctly sum up some of our mistakes, in terms of how we think about it, but also try to highlight what we actually know and what we don't know about the internet's impact. Because for me, the biggest question is, how do you then formulate policy? You know, how do you support, you know, democratization in some of those countries? And, you know, if we end up getting the answer that the internet overall has a negative influence, then we have to, you know, formulate policies which will counter that negative influence. You know, I'm not necessarily saying that's what we are going to find, but we have to be asking questions which will enable us to think critically about this.
Okay, before we dig deeper into that topic, let's go a bit back into your past. Mm-hmm. You come from Belarus. Mm-hmm. You was born there. Mm-hmm. How long did you live there?
I lived there, well, I went to high school there, so graduated high school until, 18? Yeah.
And then?
Then I went to study in the Balkans. I went to American University in Bulgaria. It's kind of a very weird school set up by Americans in the Balkans. And I was lucky enough to get a scholarship actually from George Soros to study there for 4 years. So I did my BA there, and it was a very interesting experience. I spent, and that was actually very interesting because then I joined this NGO called Transitions Online, which still is based in Prague, which is mostly working on media development, in the former Soviet Union. So they, since early 90s, they've been thinking of ways in which you can actually promote independent, responsible journalism in the former Soviet Union. And of course, 5 or 7 years ago, new media became all the rage. And for them, it was obvious that they need to expand from, you know, traditional print journalism and TV journalism and radio journalism into new media stuff. And they didn't have anyone to guide them through this. So somehow they thought I would be a good idea to sort of a good candidate to do that. So I actually found myself thinking through, you know, many of the issues I'm criticizing now, you know, thinking about ways in which, you know, activists and journalists and bloggers in Central Asia or places like Belarus or Moldova or parts of the Caucasus can actually benefit from new media. What is that they have to know about blogging and social networking or online anonymity and things like that. And that actually allowed me to get in touch and get to know a lot of donors and Western donors who are actually funding all of this, you know, and allowed me to see some of their assumptions. And many of their assumptions were, I would say, very unrealistic. You know, I felt that they haven't really thought them through to an extent that they should have. So, you know, I decided to kind of put the practical elements of this work on hold a little bit and try to look at it more from, you know, intellectual perspective. So I decided, you know, I managed to get a fellowship in New York, so I moved to the US and I started looking at, you know, what it is that guides our thinking on these issues. And that's, you know, eventually how I ended up at Georgetown now, you know, teaching a course about internet and democracy, but also continuing with my research about, you know, new media and politics and democratization. It's a short summary of, yeah.
So that sounds very, very interesting to us. But I think not all of the people listening to the podcast will have the occasion to go to Republica conference and listen to your talk. So, of course, we all would be interested to hear a little bit of how far have you got with your research about the impact of the internet on freedom of expression and other very important things. And what do you think should we have to do better with the internet?
Well, that gives me enough time to talk for the next 2 hours.
I will interrupt you, I'm sure.
Well, look, on the question sort of what's happening, right, and what have I found, well, the governments apparently are very active in this space. You know, they're active not just in terms of blocking and filtering websites, they're active in terms of, you know, paying bloggers, creating their own new media units which try to hijack certain online discussions and take them in the ideological directions that are favorable to the government. You know, in China, there is this famous 50 Cent Party, for example. Those are people who are basically being paid, you know, supposedly 50 Cent per comment to find sensitive political discussions online and simply, as I said, hijack them in ideological and topical directions which are of interest to the government. The reason why it happens, I think, is because censorship is just no longer very effective. You know, they still censor quite a lot of stuff, but because the costs of publishing have dropped so significantly, it's become very hard for people, for the censors, to contain the spread of information, right? Because, you know, they censor it on one blog and then it encourages 100 other bloggers to repost it. You know, it's what we in the West called, you know, the Streisand effect, when, you know, you're trying to suppress a certain bit of information and instead it resurfaces on hundreds and thousands of other blogs and sources. So, you know, so the only way in which you can contain that is actually try to discredit the author of the post or the post itself and say that, you know, they work for the CIA or they're all Western funded, so you should discount everything they're saying on their blog. You know, and if you get 100 people who go and say that repeatedly, you know, at some point, you know, it becomes a cost, right? It becomes kind of prohibitively expensive to police your blog against such attacks. We're also beginning to see that even the nature of control is shifting, and it's no longer just, as I said, you know, censorship and filtering. It's also things like denial of service attacks, right, where, you know, websites and blogs are being attacked and they're basically unavailable for, say, 10 days out of, you know, 30. So they are down for, you know, 2 weeks a month, 1 week a month, right? And it does put a lot of psychological pressure on people who run those websites. The problem is that we rarely register those acts of control on the radar of, you know, NGOs tracking freedom of expression, because technically they have not been blocked. They have not been censored. You know, it's like, well, your website is down. How do we know why it's down, right? Whether it's cyber attacks or whether it's too much traffic or whether you haven't paid your bill, who knows, right?
So you think it's a new way of interrupting freedom of speech, freedom of expression, by using the system failure argument against all those who are speaking against the ruling parties or the governments. So, quite interesting. So would you say that these technical measures are now
more arising compared to the legal arguments?
Of course, sure. You know, because there is no attribution. It's you know, the governments have plausible deniability. The governments, you cannot, you know, when you block a website, there will be some, you know, some court order or whatever. You know, in most cases, there will be some paper trail. You know, even, you know, in countries like China, they do have lists of websites which they block, and then those lists regularly resurface on sites like WikiLeaks, right? So we do have that. The advantage of denial of service attacks is that, you know, there is no paper trail. It's very hard to actually know that the site has been blocked. And the beauty of it is that there is no censorship circumvention software which will allow you to access that website. And if a website is blocked, you can go and use Tor or Siphon or any of the other, or, you know, you can use VPN, you can use all sorts of things to access that website. If it's being under attack, there is no way you can access it because it's being attacked at the root level, right? So there are ways in which, of course, you can think through, do multiple copies or whatever, but then there are a lot of also hidden costs. So imagine you're a community which suddenly has become critical of regime, I don't know, somewhere in Central Asia, think, you know, of Kazakhstan, for example, right? So what can we expect? A lot of people who will be paid to go and leave nasty comments on that blog, not so much to influence people, but simply to make the experience of reading other comments unpleasant and uncomfortable. You know, when you have a community which talks about, you know, world economy, and suddenly you have 100 people joining that community starting to accuse its founders of being CIA agents, you know, it does present certain costs to the community because you need to police that stuff, you need to remove it, you know, and then on top of that, if you start figuring, you know, factoring in things like cost of denial of service attacks, you know, you can end up with a website that is available 2 weeks out of four, which also is not a very healthy development community-wise. So essentially, it's an indirect way to destroy communities, you know, and that's what I think is not, you know, well studied yet.
So you think that what used to make the internet a strong medium for promoting democracy and so on is now be used and turned against those who try to speak up freely?
But I don't know who made the argument that it was a strong force for promoting democracy to start
well, at
with.
Least some do, so.
Yes, I guess. I mean, I'm not sure where you're trying to take me.
Well, you might have been. But I would like to know, you're coming from Belarus.
Yes.
So I think you're quite closely following the developments in Belarus,
yes.
Especially on the internet. And I think Belarus, which is quite close to Germany at least,
mm-hmm.
I think it's just
mm-hmm.
Poland between us,
mm-hmm.
and still a dictatorship here in
mm-hmm.
Europe, not
mm-hmm.
far away.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the usage of internet there
mm-hmm.
and the usage of internet for promoting democracy maybe against
mm-hmm.
Mr. Lukashenko?
Mm-hmm.
And how does the government react on
mm-hmm.
this?
Mm-hmm. Good question. I think the case of Belarus actually, you know, the reason why I initially myself got interested in the broader issue of sort of how does the internet impact democracy also had to do with Belarus, because obviously I was seeing that, you know, people had a lot of internet, people had access to the internet, you know, we had a lot of people online, it was, you know, comparatively high penetration rate if you compare it to other countries, and, you know, and I didn't see a lot of activists, you know.
So in the first line, the government didn't take any notice of that, people using the internet, or did they just think, well,
the government didn't take any notice because people were not using it for political reasons, just like they were not actively rising up against the regime offline, they were not doing it online either, you know, what I was seeing was a lot of young people being sucked in into this whirlpool of entertainment, you know, downloading movies illegally, and, you know, being chained to their computers and enjoying themselves.
So you say YouTube, for example, is the best way to prevent a revolution in your country?
Well, that's you said that, not me, but I do think that there is a certain element, there is a certain feature which is negatively affecting the civic engagement, and not just in Belarus. I think it's globally, and again, that dimension tends to be missing. You know, if in our discussions of the internet and authoritarian states, you know, I don't know about the debate in Germany, but I know about the debate in the United States, and you know, and like half of that discussions is whether the internet is making young people more engaged in politics. You know, whether it's making them more disengaged. You know, that debate is present. The problem is that in the case of, you know, authoritarian states, we assume that 99% of all young people are already committed to joining the revolution and risking their lives. And, you know, like, where does that assumption come from? You know, I was never able to pinpoint exactly, you know, who, like, why do we assume that that's the case? If that was the case, we wouldn't need to do anything, you know. These people would just rise up every time they had elections, you know, and they don't. But on sort of the broader question of how can you use the internet to promote democracy, the problem is that you always have side effects, and unintended consequences, which are very hard to predict. So let me give you an example. So suppose you have a Western NGO which comes into a country like Belarus and wants to start promoting blogging, right? So what does it do? It has to find local people. Right, so it finds local people who are already plugged into new media environment, who are basically already working on some projects, and most of those projects need no money whatsoever. You know, they're very cheap to run. Those people are committed to them. They're working on them. They're pretty happy. You know, and those projects actually have some traffic and they have some community built around them. What happens is that the foreign donor, foreign government comes in and creates this, free for all kind of, environment. Where, you know, you get paid good money, you have zero incentives to build successful projects, because if your projects don't succeed in year one, you can always ask for more money in year two, in year three, and year four, because it's all grant funded, right? And the donors themselves don't understand how new media works. And you end up in a situation where donors and international community actually ends up ruining the entire new media scene. So people who have to be working on sustainable entrepreneurial new media projects are driven to this hellishly expensive portals and social networks, which are entirely meaningless, have zero impact, and fail after the money runs out. And I was in the center of it all, you know, because I was working for an NGO which was getting money from the Western donors to do just that, you know, and at some point I realized we're actually causing more damage than good, you know, so what's the point? But again, you know, donors themselves have the governments to account to. So donors say, hey, you know, we've got governments. If we underspend this year, they wouldn't fund us for next year. So we have to spend all our money. You know, so you end up in this vicious circle where, like, you know, at some point I started questioning the entire model. And, you know, I'm still questioning it, you know, and I don't know much about development aid in Africa. But I assume it's even worse, you know. So, it's not. So, to the question, how do you promote the internet democracy with the help of the internet? I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't, you know. If the end result is distracting people from natural, organic, sustainable, commercially viable projects, let's just stop. You know, let's just figure out areas of intervention where we can be effective and stick to them. Whether it's anti-censorship software, whether it's protection for DDoS attacks, let's just not pour money into countries, you know. So that's kind of the message.
Yeah, I remembered an example from 1968 in Germany when you talked about 90% don't want a revolution.
Yeah.
Because 40 years ago in Germany, there were lots of young persons from the left wings, and they thought, we need a revolution. Let's go to Opel to agitate the workers. And after two or three years hanging out at Opel and working as a worker, they found out all the workers are interested in Mallorca holidays and TV and not about revolution.
Yes.
So is this, I remembered when you gave this example from Belarus.
Yes. Yeah, but I mean, but that's like the basic human nature. You know, people are not natural born revolutionaries. You know, if people were natural born revolutionaries, we'll be living in a perpetual revolution, right? But we aren't. And but that also gets you to a much deeper debate about the liberating nature of information. And, you know, and again, the assumption, like, I think people in Washington will just go crazy if tomorrow China lifts all the restrictions on the internet and virtually nothing happens. You know, it'll be like intellectual collapse of, you know, like all think tanks in America. Because, you know, they're all built on the assumption that all you have to do is to destroy the Great Firewall of China, and the Chinese will all find out about Tiananmen Square and everything else, and they will organize in groups and go topple the government. And I just think this is far away from truth. You know, I think many, like, I know from the case of Belarus, most people know that it's a very horrible, screwed up government, which, you know, doesn't respect human rights, and they're okay with it because it provides them relatively good economic growth, and it allows them, you know, to travel to better and more countries every year, you know, for holidays, you know, and they look at Ukraine and they see a disaster, you know, which is like wasted 6 or 7 years, never got into the European Union as it hoped. Nothing happened. So, like, you know, and this comparative perspective and kind of historical perspective is missing in most cases, I think, when you know. But again, it's natural that it's missing because people doing the analysis think not just in American terms, they think in Californian terms of, you know, California also around 1968. That's when I think most of that analysis kind of shaped how they think about the internet. It's that period and that region.
Well, it sounds like you're quite, how do you say it in English? You're quite interesting. You say that it's quite hard to imagine that the internet can promote democracy at all, that the internet itself is a useful tool for that. Am I right? Or am I a little bit exaggerating now? So what do you think? Can the internet, in fact, give any kind of helping of being any helping element for promoting democracy, or is the internet just the same as the offline society? Do you think it's just a mirror of it?
Well, look, I mean, if you are smart and if you know of all the possible things that can go wrong and if you can hatch against those, sure. I mean, you know, you can again work with NGO groups and make their, you know, if you're talking about human rights groups, you so can make sure that their, you know, documentation is encrypted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if they're communicating with a centralized database and they're depositing reports of human rights abuses, say in Burma, to a centralized server in California, you can make sure that that data is encrypted. You know, there are many little things which you can do. And by the way, you know, I'm still doing a lot of work for Soros and we are funding a lot of those things. You know, so I'm in the middle of all this every day. You know, it's not as if just saying the internet is a bad thing and forget about it. I'm, you know, I'm actually responsible for spending money on making that work. So yes, I do believe it can work. It's just that, you know, you have to make sure that the claims, you know, that are being made are actually in line with reality. Because, you know, I know my little kind of chunk of money, which, you know, I ever seen can help sort of spend. I'm not sure that there are the same controls in the European Union and most of the American foundations, right? So the kind of claims which are being made, you know, by Clay Shorkey, my, you know, one of my good friends, you know, they need to be checked somehow because they eventually determine how projects are being framed, how money is being spent. And I think, you know, again, I don't want to go to the dialogue with Shirky, you know, but when I first pointed to some inconsistencies in his book, when I first had that, you know, cover story in Prospect, he responded saying that, well, I agree with your criticisms, but my book was about social media. It wasn't about politics, you know. And like, I just don't know how you write a book which is not about politics, you know. So you have to be responsible for the consequences, you know. And there are people who will read that book in the State Department in the U.S. and make certain conclusions, you know. So I just think it's irresponsible to say, well, you know, it's a book about cats on the internet and lolcats and whatever. And, you know, like, because if it's just about lolcats, like, why bother, you know?
There's a long history of cats and dogs and so on in political science, too, not only on the internet. Quite interesting. No, but it sounds a little bit like you're very, very skeptic about making the same mistakes as whether it offline and now repeated on in the online world. Am I right?
Are we repeating the same mistakes? Are we committing new mistakes? Yes.
It sounds to me at least that like you're criticizing the same way of spending money in the wrong kind of projects.
Yes, but again, you know, I don't think that the assumptions which underpinned the, let me put it that way, I actually believe that many of the assumptions which underpin our thinking about the internet now, particularly in the US, all come from 1980s thinking about the Cold War. Because, you know, if you, you talk to Americans, Americans think they actually won the Cold War. You know, they think that it was Reagan who, you know, basically did all of that, you know, and it was Radio Free Europe, which, you know, like, I'm almost sure they played a role. But that's not like any kind of reasonable reading of the Cold War, you know, and what happened. And like they forget that Gorbachev, you know, did a lot of things which were so good and bad.
Who would you say teared down the wall? The Polish?
Who?
The Polish?
The Polish. You know, I'm sure. Well, I'm sure the Pope played a role, right? But I'm sure it was not the American broadcasting which did it, right? So are we repeating many of the mistakes? Yes, but we're repeating many of those mistakes because people in America fundamentally misunderstood what happened. We, you know, and it's not just the Cold War. It's also, you know, lots of myths about globalization and how it's going to destroy nation state. You know, Frank Fukuyama predicting that the history is over. You know, lots of biases, you know, and of course, all of those biases influence how you think about it. Because if you do believe that globalization results in the decline of the nation state and that, you know, it's going to become powerless, sure, you would think that authoritarian governments are losing power, right? And, but, you know, if you don't, then you don't, right? So I think at this point, it's a matter of trying to, and that's what I'm also sort of trying to do in my book, is trying to identify what are some of the biases that we bring to this issue, because it's only by being aware of those biases that we can actually focus on creating policy that just wouldn't, you know, get us into another kind of quagmire.
Well, if I got it right, you are a fellow, a Yahoo fellow,
yes,
right now.
Yes.
So, what do you think about the policy of this company?
Sure. You know, I'm free to criticize Yahoo. Like, which policy? I'd be happy to discuss any policy of Yahoo that you want to discuss. And I must tell you that I'm a fellow at Georgetown University, so my relationship to Yahoo is very indirect.
Yeah, so they are giving you, in fact, they're financing your fellowship and...
they are financing Georgetown, and Georgetown is financing me.
Okay, so that's very, very indirect. So you're doing a lot of research on all these stuff. So,
yes.
Especially on the biases, as you told us.
Yes.
But how far have you got with identifying those biases, and what are your learnings from that until now? So have you identified several quite concrete steps, or?
Sure, sure. But again, as I said, I'll be repeating myself now, but, you know, a lot of that has to do, again, with the Cold War, globalization, technological determinism. And I think technological determinism is probably more important than anything else. Mm-hmm. Do I believe that the internet drives history? No. Do I believe that technology drives history? I don't, right? And that's not the position that many people, that's not the position that is, that you see in the popular discourse, because people think that, yes, fax machines brought down the Berlin Wall, you know, and it's like, it's a common view. It's not, you know, so again, it's printing press. People do associate certain qualities with certain technologies. You know, you look at the kind of predictions people made about the airplane or about the telephone, you know, in the 20s and, you know, and before, you know, and I've been looking at all of those predictions, they're literally crazy. You know, people thought all wars will end because people can now fly airplanes. And people thought, you know, television is going to strengthen community life because everyone will be gathering, all the neighbors will be gathering by one television because it will be very expensive, so only one family per five can afford it. You know, so you look at every technology and there are a lot of very overhyped, unsupported claims, which then influence, you know, how we think about it and the kind of decisions we do, we kind of take. So, you know, and I think a lot of our discussions right now about the internet are just so ahistorical. They're not rooted in any kind of, you know, history of technology or history of society. That it's, you know, you look at the internet and you think, wow, that's the greatest thing that ever happened, and nothing happened like that before. And no, you know, people made all sorts of weird predictions about, you know, the telegraph, which was going to end all wars and result in universal peace, you know, trains, which were supposed to do the same, you know, and like there is, every technology was supposed to do that, and none of them did, you know. So I just want people who are strong believers in this to explain me what it is about the internet that is going to change the world. And, you know, they usually say, well, it's because is decentralized. You know, I don't know for how long it will stay decentralized. Is it decentralized if, you know, Google controls 70% of the search market? You know, I don't know. So, you know, we're basically the analogy which I often give when you think about, you know, how difficult it is to try to promote democracy or democratization with the help of the internet. You're basically, you know, think of yourself as being in a dark room. You know, and you're being given a pistol or gun, whatever. Your hand is shaking, and you have a target which is moving, and you have a lot of bystanders, right? And there is no light, so you have to kind of try to get it without shooting any of the bystanders, right? When your hand is shaking, meaning, you know, the internet is always changing, and the aim is changing as well, because authoritarianism and undemocratic governments are not fixed and are not stable. You know, there is, you know, China in 1989. And China in 2010 are completely different countries, you know, and so is Russia, and so is Iran. So, you know, and it's only by recognizing, you know, the complexities of what we are dealing with that we can try to be strategizing. Because if you listen to American policymakers, you know, they're so concerned with cyber war and cybersecurity, they want to re-engineer the internet, you know, to make it easier to pinpoint where cyber attacks are coming from. Well, if you're going to do that, how are you going to be promoting internet freedom in, you know, Iran and China, you know, like, so those clashes are inevitable. It's just that the policymakers are so new to the internet that they don't yet realize that their national agendas and foreign agendas are going to collide, and, you know, in a matter of years. You know, I guess my own project in the last, you know, 12 months or, you know, 18 months has been trying to highlight some of those contentious areas. Because I think if you're not aware of them, you know, we will be on, you know, what's the point of talking about internet freedom if NSA is going to restrict it in 12 months? You know, like, are we going to, as the American government, are we going to sound credible, right, if our own agencies are going to undermine the very internet freedom we are going to promote, right? And I think it's a big question, and I think it's not often asked.
Yeah, we know the situation from Germany. Yeah, but coming back to the Iran, yes. You mentioned the example of Belarus. Is the situation in Iran comparable to Belarus?
Who would know? I don't know. Is it comparable? They're both ruled by jerks, but I don't know beyond that. Is it comparable? People are not as religious in Belarus, from what I know. But I also don't see, you know, there is a certain element to the internet in Iran, which, yes, it has been useful in terms of getting information out of Tehran during the protests and immediately after the protests. That's undeniable. You know, we've seen all those tweets, we've seen all those photos and Flickr and whatnot. You know, has it been instrumental in terms of helping Iranians organize better? Like, I don't know. You know, to me, an ideal use of the internet by a revolutionary movement would be when all of your objectives are fixed, you have a centralized command and control center, you know, all of the decisions are taken, and you only use the internet to send out your orders. Not just to send out your orders, but to publicize what you have already agreed upon. Right? In that case, sure, I think, you know, it's reasonable that the, you know, a centralized opposition can actually manage. Look at the case of Iran, and you are faced with something completely different. It's a decentralized movement where there is no center of gravity, where there are lots of people in the diaspora who are tweeting and blogging, and you have no idea where those people are, whether they're in Los Angeles or whether they're in Tehran. You know, you have people who are supposed to be kind of rank and file, people who are supposed to be on the, you know, front line, so to say, also tweeting back and trying to influence policy. I'm like, how do you overthrow a government when everyone is talking and tweeting and contributing advice? You know, it's not the Wikipedia, right? They're not working on a Wikipedia article about the Iranian Revolution. They're working on the revolution itself, right? And I'm just not sure that this is where crowdsourcing actually helps. You know, I haven't been convinced that decentralizing decision making, you know, is a good idea. You look at the Bolsheviks in 1917. Like, they were not, like, it was 2,000 people, right? They were very organized. Lenin was, you know, ahead. And I don't think they, like, tolerated a lot of, you know, crowdsourcing, right? I don't think anyone was sending, you know, short messages to Lenin saying that, you know, that's what you should do. Right? So, and, you know, I'm not attaching any value judgment to that revolution, but that was a revolutionary movement which worked, right? So, you know, from that perspective, I'm not sure that the internet is of such great help. You know, the reason why it helped Obama get elected was because he had a very clear message, he had a very well-organized campaign, and they knew what they wanted from the internet, which was to raise money. You know, that's all they wanted. And maybe, you know, have a small contingent of people who would go on forums and blogs and counter the rumors that Obama wasn't born in America. That's like all that Obama wanted from the internet, was to raise money and counter the rumors. You look at the Iranian guys, like, what did they want from the internet? Was it to raise awareness in the West? Was it to organize better? Was it to spread information about the protests? What was it? You know, and I still didn't know. You look at Twitter and you get the impression that all they wanted was to make sure that CNN would eventually cover the protests. You know, they wanted to get attention in the Western media, or they wanted to get some expression of solidarity from people in the West. You know, so I don't know. I haven't been sold on the idea of the internet as the greatest revolutionary force in Iran. And I actually got even more skeptical when, after the protests, the government basically started compiling all those photos and videos and uploading them to their own website and directing people to identify who are those people in the photos. You know, and then they started tracking people on Facebook. They started asking travelers who were flying into Tehran whether they had Facebook accounts, and then looking them up. You know, I'm just not sure there was much in way of kind of facilitating the revolution. And it shows you the dual nature of these communications. You know, when we talk about the ease of mobilization in the US or in Western Europe, we don't assume that there is a secret police, which is, well, you know, we probably know that it exists, but we don't assume it to take action, right? Like in the case of Iran, I'm not sure that the ease of communication actually matters when you have the secret police, which is recording everything in real time and going to arrest people almost immediately. What's the point of, like, how's it ease of, like, what's easy about it, right? Other than, you know, it's easy to send a message, but the costs are quite real and quite high.
So, but at least the digital revolution attempts, at least, they are creating some kind of attention in the West. So, for example, yeah, a few days ago, you were blogging, yes, about the analog revolution, yes, in Kyrgyzstan, and in fact, it was not on the internet that I heard about the Kyrgyzstan revolution for the first time. So, how does that come? And what do you think makes this Kyrgyzstan example a little bit different from, for example, yes, Iran, except for having a totally different political situation there?
Well, that's a big if. And that's a big except. Well, I mean, the case of Iran, again, I think, you know, it was a revolution which nobody expected, you know, and nothing in that revolution could be explained in the digital terms. Mm. You know, yes, some young people and bloggers and, you know, journalists and activists, we're making videos and photos of the protests, we're tweeting, you know, I've been to Kyrgyzstan myself, I have friends there, I have a lot of people in my Twitter feed from Kyrgyzstan. I was watching all that, fine. But, you know, like, sure, okay, it helps to get some information out to the West. Fine, you know, I never challenged that hypothesis. The question is, you know, what happened in terms of mobilization? And I just don't think that anything happened because people were in the streets, they were rioting. They were rioting for reasons which were beyond both the government and the opposition. No one was expecting that, you know, the revolution was going to happen. Mm-hmm. The leaders of that revolution were probably expecting to go back to their families and have dinner that night, you know, not be ruling the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I didn't know. Like, I didn't see a role for the internet. And, you know, as I pointed in my foreign policy piece, you know, the Western pundits were not expecting into the revolution simply because, you know, Kyrgyzstan does not matter that much geopolitically. So, you know, and again, you have to understand how American media works, you know, and probably works more or less the same here. You know, it's, you have to get an angle, you have to get a new angle to every story. So if you are supposed to be talking about Iran, you know, 23 hours out of 24, you'll dream up everything. You'll dream up the Twitter revolution, you'll dream up, you know, the Google revolution, Facebook revolution, you'll find a role for Wikipedia, you know, but if you only have 10 minutes to talk about Kyrgyzstan, we'll probably talk about the U.S. military base there, not about Wikipedia, yeah. Right? So I think it's still primarily the relative importance that such subjects receive in the Western media then leads to more hype.
So you think it's a good headline to have a revolution of the revolutions itself? So like having a Facebook revolution, having a Twitter revolution. So something like happened in Moldova some mm-hmm. days ago, a month ago. I think it was 1 year ago or 2 years ago.
Exactly a year ago. Which
is said to be started on Twitter and Facebook, I think. Uh-huh. So do you know this example quite well?
I coined the term.
Yeah, so, okay, so, I'm sorry. Didn't know that you coined it. I read it about it in Russian first, so maybe that's the reason why I didn't notice that it was you who coined it. So, why do you think that's a different example from that? Because I think Moldova, which is quite close to the EU already, especially due to the quite close connections to Romania, I think. Mm-hmm. So, why do you think Twitter and Facebook had an impact there compared to most other examples?
Well, because that was a protest led by young people in the youth channels to spread information that they were most comfortable with. You know, they used LiveJournal, they used Twitter apparently, you know, they used a few other tools. And but that was a planned protest, you know. And again, I don't think they properly estimated the kind of turnout they were going to get, you know. So they also were probably going to go and have dinner with their families that night, and they were not planning to, you know, participate in looting of the parliament. You know, to me, the difference is obvious. It was actually, they intentionally used Twitter to organize, you know, as opposed to you know, others. But you know, the problem with talking about these issues is that it's very hard to link the number of people you see in the streets mm-hmm. with the actual effect that Twitter was having. You know, my argument back then, a year ago, was that the main feature of that revolution in Moldova, which, you know, wasn't really a revolution, but the main feature of it was that it allowed Moldovans abroad and their supporters abroad to participate in events remotely. You know, and that was, to me, the most important feature. That, and they managed to capitalize on the relative newness of Twitter in American and Western discourse. They managed to hijack the newness of Twitter and turn Moldova into some kind of an interesting story. You know, and we saw that this year, you know, no one already gives a damn about Twitter, so no one gave a damn about Kyrgyzstan. Mm-hmm. You know, if Kyrgyzstan happened last April, I assure you it would be the same kind of, you know, hype around Twitter in Moldova.
Maybe just for our listeners, you can say how many inhabitants Moldova in fact has. I think it's quite low.
Well, I think it's 4 million, and a million is somebody missing working abroad.
So that's at least more Twitter users, more than the Twitter users in Germany, but but compared to the Twitter users in the US, for example, that's probably quite low, even if everybody in Moldova would be a Twitter user.
Yeah, but there were very few. But even in Iran, you look at Iran, apparently they only had 20, 6,000 users before the protest started, you know, and it wasn't clear how many of them were actually abroad. In Moldova, it was a few hundred before the protest started, you know. So, but that's exactly what I was saying. You know, if you have a bunch of young people, like, you know, Chisinau is not such a big city. You got a bunch of young people standing in the central square. People are bored. They'll go and join them. You know, you don't have to be on Twitter to go and join. You know, like, it used to have. That's how revolutions happened all the time. You know, there is a crowd standing there. I'll go and check out what they're doing.
So the revolution still happens offline.
Well, that's not the lesson, but it's very hard to find the exact causation. You know, the fact that there are people standing on the square doesn't mean that they need to have a BlackBerry to figure out that something is going on in their city. You know, so and I think that's something that again goes missing. On it's as if, you know, we didn't have any revolutions before BlackBerries. You know, and before the internet. That's, you know, what did we use before? Pigeon mail? No, people still knew that something was happening and had their own heuristics and shortcuts and, you know, the social networks. They used, like, regular phones. All of that happens, you know, and I didn't know to what extent that was responsible for getting the crowd out in a place like Moldova. And I don't think anyone looked at that that deeply.
I totally agree with you that digital technologies can be used for control, can be used very good for control. And we see these examples in the authoritarian regimes.
Yes.
We also have the debates in Europe, like the data retention or net censorship.
Yes.
Almost all technology comes from Europe or the United States and is exported to authoritarian regimes.
Yes.
Why is there no embargo? It would be so
easy. That's a question I should be asking you. But I'd be willing to take it, yes. Why the no embargo? I mean, why? Because, again, there is this belief that technologies are neutral and that the responsibility of the engineer stops at designing the technology and not in thinking about how those technologies are being put to use. And also Cisco can make a very nice argument saying that, hey, We're engineers. We take no positions. We have no moral claims. We just build this router, and you know the way Iranians or Chinese are gonna use it. You know, it's not up to us. But I do think that they do make a certain point, which I do find reasonable. You know, it's not as if this technology is so unique that no one else can do it. You know, you impose an embargo on Cisco, which, you know, or Nokia, Siemens, or any other companies, you know, Huawei or any other local Asian or Russian companies will take in that place, and now they'll just take in that place faster. I just don't think that's the kind of technology on which you can impose a global embargo.
So it's better than that the NSA is part of the deal because they have good contacts to Cisco and co. Then,
well, it depends on where your allegiances are. You know, it's whether you have FSB in charge or you have NSA in charge. Someone will be in charge. But, you know, I think it's ultimately a question of... it's a question of civil society here. You know, if it's a big issue, yes, I do think that there should be some kind of embargo. I don't think it's going to solve the problem. It may have negative consequences, you know, also. For ethical reasons, sure, you know, let's ban them. Why not?
So there's been a lot of examples for that in history already about dual use goods of all kinds. For example, gas stuff for Iraq and so on, and other things. So you think that the vendors and manufacturers and suppliers and even maybe services online should be taken more into responsibility?
Well, sure, of course I do. But
so, what kind of responsibility? What do you think about
it? Well, but, you know, it's not... it's a matter for these industry groups to look deep into their own soul, you know, and if they need, bring a few applied ethicists and philosophers to, you know, look at these issues And, you know, I do think that there needs to be pressure on many of these industries, not so much in companies themselves, because I think, you know, one company will stop, another one will start. But on the industries, yes, I do think that the responsibility is much deeper. And I think it's enough to be hearing all these arguments about neutrality of technology, because I just don't believe the technology is neutral. You know, and I don't think it's neutral, and I think it's never been neutral in the history of the world, and I think it's a big myth. And, you know, the sooner we rid ourselves of that myth, the sooner we would be able to delegate responsibility properly.
So what do you think about the role of politics and politicians?
The role of politics and politicians in that process, in general.
Especially in this process. No, not in general.
Well, I mean, someone has to kick the ball, you know, and someone has to set the ball rolling. So, you know, sure, politicians can try to legislate. I do think we need to have more legislation, you know, we need to have more regulation. You know, I'm not opposed to that by far, just that regulation needs to be smart and reasonable. I think in the U.S., there are many problems which occur simply because the internet is completely unregulated. You know, there is no privacy commissioner in the U.S. simply because it's not how they work. So Facebook can do whatever it wants, and Google can do whatever it wants. Yeah, I just don't think it's healthy.
But do you think that we should be lucky that at least in most of the more authoritarian states, just like our democratic states, many of the politicians still don't really get what the internet is all about?
Should we be lucky? No, I don't think we should be lucky. I don't think there is anything about the internet that they can get. You know, it's like, I don't think there is any essence to the internet that they can, you know, read the book Internet for Dummies and they will get all the five essential features. Like, I just, it's going back to this bigger question about technological determinism. Mm-hmm. You know, are there some features of the internet which are shaping how we live and how we behave? No. You know, I think that's also part of my argument, you know, in authoritarian countries. Well, you know, yes, supposedly it's decentralized, but, you know, authoritarian governments found a way in which to subvert the decentralization and use it for their own purposes, you know, to better monitor what's happening and to, you know, do data processing, you know, and whatnot, and use it for propaganda and censorship, right? So that doesn't convince me that there is any essence. I will like it that our politicians are technologically literate, which I think is a much better description. No, you know, but I don't think that them getting literate would necessarily mean dumber regulation. You know, I think there is a much greater chance that they will be regulating in very dumb and ineffective ways if they still think that the internet is a series of tubes, like, you know, many American politicians seem to believe. But again, I think it's a matter for civil society to figure out, you know, run campaigns, run awareness campaigns, you know, do more public advocacy and raise awareness, and I think it will all be fine.
Yeah, we need more. The first time I read something from you was an article about selectivism.
Okay.
I found it very interesting because I hadn't heard anything about it, but I got it at once. Can you explain what selectivism means?
Sure. Well, selectivism is kind of this practice of feel-good activism, where what is required of you is very little, but it makes you feel really good and important, and, you know, makes you feel as if you're changing the world. So I think online, particularly on Facebook and Twitter, we do see a lot of slacktivism where people join a Facebook group to, you know, feed all the children of Africa, but this is where their ambition stops. You know, they do nothing else. All that happens is they get a lot of spam, and that's where it all ends. You know, they get a lot of spam emails about feeding Africa, and then they join 25 other causes. And essentially, they don't contribute to any of them anymore. I do think that that's happening. Again, the question is, does it matter? you know, and what does it do to the political process? There are many people who say, hey, well, you know, it's all about the long tail. You just, you know, you get a lot of people, they all contribute 1 cent, and essentially we all add it up, and then we feed, you know, the entire Africa somehow with all those donations. I just don't think that's how it works, you know, because I think we all have limited amount of time, limited amount of attention, limited amount of money, and it has to be used, you know, effectively, right? So the kind of questions we need to be asking is, you know, does the fact that you join a Facebook group on a social issue make it less likely that you will get involved with that issue offline or through other more effective means? Does the fact that you join a Facebook group on a particular issue makes it more or less likely that you will contribute money to a particular cause? I think those are all big questions which I think people in academia should start asking, but I'm not sure that the answer to all of them is automatically yes. You know, Facebook turns you into, you know, Mother Teresa or, you know, Gandhi. You know, I don't think that's a trajectory in all cases. You know, maybe in 5% it is a trajectory. You know, in some cases you just think you are becoming Mother Teresa, but like you're not doing anything of the kind. And I think this is kind of the trap of slacktivism, where it really is. You know, it gives you this idea of false empowerment. It's almost like false class consciousness. You know, it's just think it's all fine and good, and but it isn't.
Yeah, but is it a new thing?
No, I don't think it's a new thing, you know, and I don't think it has to do with the internet. It's just that the internet adds many interesting elements, because now it's not just you who feels that you're mother, like Mother Teresa, you're also broadcasting it to 100 of your friends, so they also think you're cool, you know, and like, so there is this reputational angle, and there is this visibility which wasn't there before, you know, so like, why bother being good if you're just sitting on your sofa, is not going, no one is going to notice that, but if you're on Facebook, you know, your goodness is visible. And you know, it adds a certain behavioral element, I think, which was missing before.
So maybe we are now changing from a charity society to just an attention charity society, or.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure there is much attention in those campaigns, though. It's more like attention deficit disorder society.
That's a little bit cynic, isn't it?
No, but, you know, I'm just not sure that, you know, because, my experience of talking to, I'm not even on Facebook, so what the hell would I know? But, you know, my experience of talking to people who are is that, you know, yes, they join all those groups, and, like, it's not that if they all suddenly become active on 25 groups, and they all suddenly become attentive to issues happening there. Like, I'm fine, join one group and, like, work on it. Like, you know, don't spread yourself too thinly. You know, you can't be meaningfully contributing to 25 different issues, even if the cost of contributing is so low, because you still have the same amount of attention and capital to spend. And what's worse, when everyone can send you a message, chances are everyone will. You know, so you end up dealing with this over-communication thing, and I'm just not sure that it's particularly helpful, even if you're dealing with 3 or 4 issues.
So you're going to publish a book quite soon?
November, yes.
So in November. And I would like to know, are you going to advertise for your book on Facebook, for example?
Advice?
Advertise.
Oh, am I going to advertise?
Yes.
In what way?
So maybe are you going to make a fan page there?
On Facebook?
Yes.
I haven't decided yet. You know, my publisher gave me leeway. My American publisher gave me leeway. They said, you know, we don't expect you to, but if you want, that would be good. You know, I do see instrumental value in that. You know, I do see a lot of instrumental value in Twitter. You know, I joined Twitter last year, about a year ago, actually, exactly for the same purpose. And in terms of self-promotion advertising, great value. You know, I don't challenge that.
So for self-promotion, it works, but for creating a revolution, for example, or changing politics, it's not that easy.
Well, I mean, like, I see the results, you know? Like, I see the results in my case, and I see the results in the case of a revolution.
So for publishing your book is not a part of your research itself, it's more, it's a little bit more.
You know, no, but it's, you know, it's a good question, I think. But I just think that the kind of logistics involved in publishing a book and getting access to platforms which you need to get access to, yes, the internet does help you to bridge those. You know, and my book, I'm actually, you know, I have in the introduction, I'm actually stating that very straightforwardly, that, you know, without the internet, I wouldn't be what I am and I wouldn't be writing what I'm writing. The problem is that you shouldn't be treating outliers as a representative of the entire class, right? So, you know, if looking at me, you're going to make an argument that the web will turn every Belarusian into, you know, a contributor to Wall Street Journal, that would be a very wrong assumption to draw, right? Because I think ultimately, even in my case, all of those achievements had only very little to do with the internet and had much more to do with the human factors and the kind of opportunities I had and the kind of people that helped me through, and not with the fact that I could tweet myself to death, you know.
So maybe there's some correlation, but it's not the causality.
Well, it certainly has instrumental value, but in it and of itself, it's not enough for anything, you know, and even for self-promotion.
So your book comes out in November. So would you like to tell us a little bit more about your book? So what's in it, and why should we be interested in your book?
Oh, well, you should be interested in my book, because I think it'll be very funny and ironic and somewhat cynical, but not very cynical. It will have some policy advice. I'm sort of also trying to think what can be done, you know, and I'm particularly troubled with, you know, the spread of online propaganda. I'm troubled with this new means of control. I think there are certain strategies which the Western governments and foundations can adopt to make that happen. And I do think there are certain strategies that they need to adopt to counter the kind of authoritarian dimension to their own internet policy at home, which I think will eventually make it impossible for them to sound credible in internet freedom abroad. I do discuss the relationship between, you know, big internet companies in Silicon Valley and the U.S. government, because I also find it troubling. You know, I find it troubling that people think that Twitter and Google are closely affiliated with the State Department. I don't see what either of them gains by that, you know, by that association. So a lot of that will be very specific policy advice. Some of it, I think the first few chapters will be very good reading in terms of just intellectually, you know, going through how do you actually even position the internet and the sort of overall history of technology, how it fits, how to think about it, why we got it wrong, you know, how to get it better. But I think the bigger question, you know, which the book answers, is why it matters. You know, why even think about the internet and democracy? And I think the big answer here is that, well, as I've said, a lot of our actions have consequences which are actually detrimental to democracy. And we just can't afford getting it wrong anymore, because at this point, you know, as I point out, authoritarian governments are using it. Activists are using it often without realizing that they're subjecting themselves to tremendous risks by being on Facebook and Twitter. You know, there is just too much to lose, you know. So we either smarten up and we actually start treating it seriously and we start thinking about it seriously, or, you know, things will get worse. You know, that's essentially the message. You know, you either take it seriously or, you know, you'll have even more problems to deal with in the very near future.
So do you see any chance that the internet or digital technology will solve all the problems and help spreading democracy in authoritarian regimes? For example, if the hacker community gets more active in creating free infrastructures which are independent from big companies like Google or Twitter, using crypto and privacy-enhancing other tools, yeah. So the people will have infrastructure to communicate anonymously and independently from national companies.
Yeah. Well, again, you have even leave the internet alone. You know, let's just leave it outside of this analysis of this framework. you have to understand what makes people revolt and ask for a better future. You know, and I'm just not sure that all of them are at a condition where they want to start communicating secretly and be working on a revolution. I just don't think that that's how it is. You know, most of them aren't. Most of them are satisfied with the current economic, political, and social conditions and have no reasons to revolt. You know, and that's not a problem which the introduction of safe communications can solve. You know, it's essentially a problem of, you know, the Chinese government managing to create an ideology for its people where, you know, they're satisfied with somewhat restrictive climate of, you know, on political rights in exchange for secure economic development, you know, and not faltering during the time of the economic crisis where everyone else in the world is faltering. You know, this is not something which you can just break with privacy-enhancing tools. You know, this is essentially an argument about ideology. You know, and sure, you can try to make appealing documentaries made in Hollywood, which in 30 seconds will explain why capitalism is better, and start distributing those, documentaries on USB sticks throughout China. I just don't think it's gonna, you know, it's like you need like 300 hours, not 30 seconds, to make that point. You know, I'm not even sure that having seen what happened in the Soviet Union and having seen the cost of transition in Russia, you know, in 1996, very few people would predict that Russia would be a democracy by year 2000, you know, before the second presidential elections. You know, and you shouldn't forget that. You know, and the Chinese were the ones who learned all the right lessons from the fall of the Berlin Wall and the decade of transition. You know, and you shouldn't, like, expect that the Chinese are sitting there thinking that, hey, when the Communist Party falls, we'll have democracy immediately, free elections, you know, and everything will be smoothly, and forget about Tibet and the Uyghurs and everything else, and they're not going to have any problems, life will be cool. No, they have all those costs, and I'm just not sure that the internet fundamentally alters that calculus. You know, it's still the same decision-making that they have to go through, you know, and it's still the same legitimacy that, you know, the government rests upon. So, the big question is, how do you utilize the power of the internet to make an argument that the transition is going to be free and painless? And the thing is, like, we all know it's not going to be free and painless. So essentially, it's a question of, you know, how do you dupe the Chinese into buying the capitalist dream and incurring all the costs, you know, of the transition? And, like, I don't know. Maybe we need some cooler virtual reality technology that, you know, they put on some glasses and their new reality in which, you know, that cost of transition is just painless. I mean, I don't know. But I think, you know, and that's the problem when you get technologists to talk about these issues, because all they talk about is, you know, yeah, cost is cheap, you know, everything is cheap, people can mobilize. Fine, but it's not the cost of mobilization which is preventing most of those people from toppling their governments. It's like completely different social and political issues. So dropping those costs, it's not altering much, you know. So I think we have to get our political science and sociology in order before we start thinking about how technology can alter anything, you know. And I don't think that even now in 2010, I don't think we still have a good grasp of what happened in the 90s. Not to say that we have a good understanding of what happened in the late 80s. You know, until we answer those two questions, I don't think anything will happen with technology-wise. We'll have some swings like we had in Kyrgyzstan, you know, but last week. But in 2005, they also had a revolution, which everyone was lauding as the next big revolutionary development, democracy is coming. In 2010, Ukraine is back to where it was, more or less. At least it's the same power that was ruling Ukraine 2006. Four, okay, they, you know, now they have more democratic procedures. You know, Kyrgyzstan is, you know, back where it was. Well, who knows? Back where it was in 2005, at least, after the revolution. I'm not sure how long Georgia will stand. You know, and like, what happened with all the color revolutions? You know, and again, it all happened because the assumptions were naive to start with, and those assumptions have nothing to do with technology, unfortunately.
Okay, I think we are over.
Good.
It was very interesting. Thank you for this.
Thanks. Well, I hope it wasn't too depressing.
No. It's a Netzpolitik podcast. It's the usual topic.
Good.
Yeah, thank you for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And we wish you good luck with the book, and thanks. We will read it. Will you publish it under a Creative Commons license?
I doubt it. No, but it will be very creative.
Yeah, we will find it on BitTorrent, I think, or in the local bookstore, maybe. Thank you for this, and have fun.
Thanks. Okay.